actually on in their constituency period, and we have to get special permission, which we do receive when dealing with legislation, to hold such a meeting. But there isn't a member here who would perhaps not rather be in the constituency engaging with South Africans. Having said that, welcome to all the members here. Thank you for being here with us this afternoon. And a very quick welcome to the DTI, the DDG there, Dr. Evelyn Masocha, who's here with us today. And I'm only mentioning the first names because we're running out of time, as well as the National Credit Regulator there, Chief Executive Officer, Ms. Nomsa Machigare. We also have the National Consumer Tribunal, Professor Maseko, and Advocate Charmaine van der Merwe, the Senior Parliamentary Legal Advisor Drafting. I will mention the others as we move along, so you won't be left out of this. On that note, there is an amendment to the agenda. We are going to have under, I think it's the first item after apologies, we will have the input from Advocate Charmaine van der Merwe before the DTI. Is that correct? Yes. Just allow me to put this to you and then to raise your hands, all right? So that's purely the agenda for this afternoon. Nothing else. I will address the program. Yes?
Chair, you will know that I wrote to you and Mr. Hermans requesting that a letter be tabled to the committee for urgent discussion because the consequences of the letter are quite serious from the DTI. And then the second one was to discuss when the resumption of the hearings into procurement, specifically with respect to Transnet. And we know that the circumstances around that particular issue have changed quite substantially since then. So I would just like to formally table that letter to the committee so that we can discuss it on an urgent basis and then to find out when we can resume the discussions.
Yes, you may have been on party business on the day I did refer to a programming decision on localisation, where it was made clear that the bills have to come before that. That is the situation in Parliament. Bills take priority. So we certainly would like to deal with it, because it was our earnest hope last year, in fact, that we would have the space to deal with it. But unfortunately, we do have a lot of bills on the table. Having said that, it is not off the program. It is not off the radar. We have not taken it off, and you should get that understanding very clear. Legislation takes priority. It's quite simple. But with respect to the letters, I would like to go over them with Mr. Hermans. And perhaps we can have a meeting after this meeting, Mr. Hermans, or tomorrow morning, right? But thank you for bringing that to our attention again, Honourable Macpherson, thank you. That is the agenda for today, but it is also, I do need to raise another item, which I should have done perhaps it's still opening and welcome here. That is the programme. In discussions with staff early this morning at 8 o'clock, it became very clear that we had not expected so many responses to the advertisement. And not only do our own staff have to study them, but so does the DTI. So they have requested, can we please consider postponing the 7th and the 8th to enable them to apply their minds more effectively, one. Secondly, the responses from, I think, the Ministry of Justice are not yet with us, and a couple of other issues which are pertinent to our discussions as we take the matter forward. And that bill that I'm referring to there is on the 7th here. Just let me get it. 7th. I see the 14th.
I've changed
it. Oh, you've new program. All right. You know, when people move a little bit faster than one expects, yes. So it was the Copyright Amendment Bill, all right? And then the other bill was the two days on the Copyright Amendment Bill. So I'm not going to simply put something back. Secondly, Parliament, the political office bearers, as well as the chairperson, the Honourable Froelich, will not agree that we come back on the 7th and 8th to conduct an inquiry, per se, because it's constituency period. So on that basis, I can't use those 2 days for some other matter. The other issue is with respect to SABS. It had been our intention to bring SABS back today, if not today, by Thursday. We have been informed of changes the Minister has made there, and they were meeting with the Auditor General today. So we do need, in the interests of fairness, to give them the space to be effectively prepared for our engagement. So I have asked Mr. Hermans to factor them in later in the programme, and that will be done. With respect to ITAC, we are in discussions at the moment. That's why I was discussing this with Advocate van der Merwe. Parliament, we would like to consider having a closed meeting for certain parts of the ITAC engagement now that we have studied the legislation. Because in the legislation, it is very specific about what can be in the public sphere, even in Parliament, and what outside. So before putting it on the agenda effectively, in fact, it still is there. It is on the agenda. We are currently consulting the legal office bearers of Parliament. Thank you. So that's just with respect to the programme. And I've asked Mr. Hermans if he would ensure that by tomorrow morning our programme has been concretised. So I'm not asking you to adopt that per se, but rather to brief you on the matter. With respect to today's agenda, I would like someone, taking into account what you've said, Honourable MacPherson, all right, to please adopt the agenda for today. Thanks, Honourable Williams, seconded by, yes, the I always like to choose different people all the time. Is it the Honourable Buyani? Was your finger upright?
Sorry, Chair, I couldn't second the agenda because I don't have one.
Right. I took a decision during the constituency after great meditation not to do the work of the administration. Right. We had the Honourable Williams proposing the adoption. We had the Honourable Buyani seconding it. And as I said, Honourable MacPherson, that included noting what you had said. And as my response to you is that we will study that with Mr. Hermans tomorrow and the whip. And tomorrow morning we will come back to you in the meeting. Is that acceptable? Right, it is. Thank you. Now, I'm sorry you were drinking water. Right. The apologies. I lost everything.
Chair, we have an apology from Ms. Advocate Albert, who's busy with party business. Ms. Shlongwini the same, as well as Mr. Mashlobo.
Right. They're all doing party business. Yes, thank you very much there. We've also got the IFP here. Yes, put that off. We've just got Honourable Esterhazen. Did you want to give an earlier or late apology?
Good, Madam Chair, thank you. I've already told the Secretary I'm leaving earlier. My wife's having operation tomorrow, so I'm going to plan out tonight.
Thank you for being here to start the meeting. Thank you. And I hope if the operation is successful. That's all of us agree on that. Thank you. So we're going to now ask Advocate van der Merwe, is this correct? Yes. You're going to, just as people are fetching their documents, because I don't like you being disturbed, we also acknowledge Mr. Kumkani, Director CCRD DTI, Mr. Zodwa Matawani, Director CCRD, Ms. Machadi, is it? Matonzi, Director. Yeah, CCRD. Mr. Obert Tongwani from the National Credit Regulator, the Deputy CEO, Mr. Lesibi Mashapa, Company Secretary, and there we are then. Hopefully that was all of you. Thank you. Well, they are very quiet, aren't they? So let's proceed.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good afternoon, members. Unfortunately, it seems we have a little bit of a problem with our projector, so you have the slides. The presentation that was handed out to you deals with both the opinion that we received from Advocate Trengov as well as further submissions, but I'll start with the opinion and deal with that and then maybe just pause for a moment.
Just one moment, Advocate. I feared this would happen. Yes, I saw Honourable Tierko with a hand up.
I think this side there are no documents.
There is a technical problem, but we, of course, there were parliaments before electricity and electronics. So let us not find ourselves not undertaking the business of the House. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. So I will start with the opinion from Advocate Trengov, and perhaps just to remind members what we asked of him. The request to him was specifically to consider the constitutionality of the debt relief measure that our bill creates, as well as the measure that we provide for the minister to prescribe. So it was a limited scope opinion. So his opinion, first off, if we look at the debt relief measure, he says that he agrees that it is deprivation of property. We knew this as a committee, so that is not news to us. He then says that it is, however, permissible and lawful under Section 25(1) of the Constitution. And if you have his opinion, you will find that on paragraph 32. And the reason why he says the debt relief measure itself is constitutional, should pass constitutional muster, is that, number one, it occurs in terms of a law of general application. That is the one thing that we did consider and made sure that it was included. So he agrees that the bill is a law of general application. Secondly, the bill is not arbitrary in that it is procedurally fair. That was one of the biggest criticisms against our draft 5, the one that was first advertised, that we did not have a fair procedure. So it was one of the things that this committee really sat and worked on, and we made sure that our procedure covers every single stakeholder and gives every stakeholder a voice. And he has indicated for him that that he is of the view that it is accordingly procedurally fair the way that it reads now. And in fact, paragraph 27 I would like to read specifically what he says. He says, credit providers who are deprived of their contractual claims are afforded an opportunity to place evidence before and make submissions to the tribunal whenever it takes a decision to suspend or cancel their rights. So that is exactly what we strived for, to make sure that at every step there is a hearing. He also adds that the tribunal's decisions to suspend or cancel is administrative action. So in any event, you would have had your administrative justice principles applying. The second thing that he says why it is not arbitrary is because you have a procedural leg and you have a substantive leg. So he says it's not arbitrary, it complies with the procedural leg. And then he says clearly there is sufficient reason. So the substantive leg is also complying. And he is indicating that, and I would also like to read from his opinion. So it is paragraph 31.1 and 31.4. The purpose and effect are to afford poor people the kind of relief that has always been available to more affluent debtors in distress, i.e. to relieve insolvent debtors of the indefinite burden of debts that they cannot realistically ever repay. I think that captures the reason for this bill so well. Then he also points out in paragraph 31.2-3 that the debt is actually only cancelled once there is no real prospect that the debtor will be able to repay the debt. And accordingly, when the credit provider's claim has become irrecoverable and worthless or worth very little. So it seems that we have now got it. You know, our bill really, really puts it out there. We are clearly in our bill getting the message across of what we want to achieve and how to achieve it. Then, so that is the good news. So then he continues on and he looks at other aspects. And there is a constitutional concern that he raises in respect of two of the clauses. So I'll first just speak to his constitutional concerns. The first one is about clause 13, and it relates to the minister extending the operation of the measure related to extinguishing of debt. In other words, our sunset clause. So members will recall, and I'm sorry if you do recall, and I'm now repeating it, but just to refresh our memories, because it has been some time, our bill, originally, the first draft that we worked on and sent to the public, had a step-by-step approach. So we looked at whether you could afford to repay. If not, there would be suspension. If you still couldn't, there would be another suspension and then extinction. It was almost a flow of one measure. Then, because of all the criticism, we reworked it and we repackaged it. And our measure now makes a clear distinction. You have that first approach. It's almost like a debt review, but it is something that government will pay for in the sense that it will be a service offered by the regulator. So you cannot afford to go to a debt counselor, you come to the regulator. The first thing that the regulator will do is to see if you can repay your debt. If you can repay your debt, then they will assist you for restructuring of that debt over a period of 5 years. And that measure, from the consultation that this committee did, became clear that first off, there is a need for this to not just be for a couple of years. There's a need for this to be there as a more permanent measure. And in any event, for the regulator, for the credit bureaus, for the banks, the credit providers, to set up their systems to incorporate this is quite a costly exercise. So to limit this operation to a couple of years made the bill not cost effective. So the decision was that that becomes a more permanent measure. Then we also have a provision, if a person cannot solve in that 5 years, in other words, he cannot or she cannot repay a debt in 5 years, then do we refer for suspension, and then there's a period of suspension and an extension, and only then is there extinguishing. And that measure, the committee has said, but we don't think that should be permanent yet. It would be good for that to be permanent, but we need to first see what the impact is. And because of that, the committee bill then limits its operation to 48 months. So the regulator can, for 48 months, refer applications for the suspension and for extinguishing. After that 48 months, that measure falls away. Unless, and this is what the bill provides for, the minister does an impact assessment and sees that this works well, and then the minister can extend that operation. Because then the fear of the committee has been addressed and it is an extension. However, council's view is that this allowing the minister to extend is exceeding the powers that Parliament has to delegate. What he points out is that the other clause, sorry, let me maybe just do both clauses. The other clause about the minister prescribing a measure, he says in the same sense that exceeds the power that Parliament can delegate, because it constitutes the delegation of plenary powers. In other words, the right of Parliament to make and amend legislation. He indicates that although the Constitution does not expressly tell us what Parliament can delegate and can't, it is clear that it is allowed. So Parliament can delegate. That's the first step. And paragraph 36 of his opinion deals with that. And then you will see on the, sorry, I think my slides are one out. On the next slide, I will discuss that case law. Then the next thing that he indicates is legislative powers are usually delegated to fill in the detail of an existing statute rather than serving as an open-ended license to legislate. So in other words, we give the executive the authority to colour in between the lines, so to speak, and not to amend legislation. And that is paragraph 37 of his opinion and the case law we will look at just now. And lastly, he says, it is ordinarily for the legislature to regulate any limitation of constitutional rights, and it should not be left to the discretion of the executive. And we'll discuss that on the third case. And I would actually like to point out that I do not agree with him that this is what that case says, because in fact, in that case, the limitation of constitutional rights is in fact delegated to the Minister of Home Affairs. It deals with immigration matters. Then he also expresses a concern that when we look at the prescribing of a debt relief measure, that there's almost no limitation. He says the definitions do not assist us at all in limiting the delegated powers. And members will remember that even when we discussed the last draft, we were not happy with the definitions, because it says it doesn't say more than what the word means. It is a difficult, both of the terms are difficult terms, so we try to define it in relation to an act, the one, the disaster, and the exogenous shock we try to define in respect of specific events. But it is a difficult, both of them are difficult terms to define. The only real limitation is the categories of persons, and it also indicates that there's no limit on the type of measure that the minister may introduce. And on this, I just want to point out, I don't think that was ever the intention of the committee. It is an oversight on the drafting side. So it is something that we'll definitely have to correct, because it was never the intention for it to be any measure. On the next slide now, slide 5, what I want to do, and I'm sorry that it sounds a bit like a law lecture that I'm giving to members, but everything that council has indicated about the delegation of the power to make regulations, I'm of the view is a very strict and academic approach to constitutional court judgments. And I will explain as we go through the cases why I view that there is a different interpretation possible as well. When we look at constitutional court cases, and that's why I'm going to take you through each of these cases, the constitutional court does not give us general rules to apply to every case. So when you look at the decision of a constitutional court judgment, you need to go and see what the facts of that matter was, because that tells you why the court reached that decision. If your facts change, the court could actually come to a different decision. And you'll see from some of the cases, the court actually have found the delegations to be constitutional. So it really depends on quite a lot. And all of these cases give us some pointers. So yes, we must consider those pointers that the Constitutional Court give us. but we must also be cautious not to apply them so strict that we lose the effectiveness of our legislative system. There's a reason for delegated legislation. There are certain circumstances that just makes it more effective. So in the first case, the Executive Council Western Cape Legislature versus the President, here, this dealt with a very old act, the Local Government Transition Act, which in fact allowed the President to amend legislation. So in other words, through a delegated legislation, through a notice, the President could by himself amend legislation. So this is where the court indicated that there's nothing in the Constitution that prohibits Parliament from delegating subordinate regulatory authority to other bodies. It is a power that is necessary for effective lawmaking. So that's what I'm saying. We need to keep in mind that there is a reason for delegation of legislation. But the court said there is a difference between delegating authority to make subordinate legislation within the framework of a statute and the power to amend an act. And in this case, like I said, there was an actual amendment of the act allowed through delegation. The court further said that it is a necessary implication of the Constitution that Parliament should have the power to delegate subordinate legislative powers to the executive. To do so is not inconsistent with the Constitution. It is necessary to give efficacy to the primary legislative power that Parliament enjoys. But to delegate to the executive the power to amend or repeal acts is quite different. So this is just the first case, and with the scenario, the facts that we keep in mind that there was an actual amendment power delegated. And this is then where the court was saying, no, you must always allow the executive to operate within the framework of an act, because that is where the legislative power of Parliament is then found. The next case is the Justice Alliance of South Africa versus the President. And this was the decision by the President regarding the decision of the President to extend the term of office of the Chief Justice. Now, what we need to keep in mind in this case, what makes it a little bit unique, is that Section 176 of the Constitution requires that the term of office of the Chief Justice may only be extended by an act of Parliament. So there's a constitutional obligation for it to be an act. And the court then says, if you look at the act itself, it conferred significant and wide discretion on the President, and Parliament has not even sought to furnish any or adequate guidelines for the exercise of that discretion. But the question of whether Parliament may delegate, again, is whether the Constitution permits that delegation. And of course, if the Constitution says it must be an act of Parliament, you kind of forget this feeling that no, you cannot delegate this, especially if you're looking at the subject matter. This is about the Chief Justice and the term of service. It affects one of the pillars of the separation of powers in our government system. So what the court also said is that the primary reason for delegation is to ensure that the legislature is not overwhelmed by the need to determine minor regulatory details. Delegation relieves Parliament from dealing with detailed provisions that are often required for the purpose of implementing and regulating laws. It is often a pragmatic grant of power to fill in the detail of a policy laid down by primary legislation. However, it is not a power which has been transferred to the final decision maker to be used as they see fit or alienated by them. In other words, again, that issue of amending or making legislation outside of the legislature. So in this case specifically, the concern was that the Constitution required an act of Parliament. The next page, the next slide deals with two cases. The first one is the matter of Dawood versus the Minister of Home Affairs. This is the matter that Advocate Trengov indicates is where the court has indicated that if you limit a constitutional right that should not be done through delegated legislation. And if I explain to you what this is about, you'll understand that why I'm saying I don't agree with him, that that is what the court said. In this matter, the court actually considered the constitutionality of a discretion given to officials of the Department of Home Affairs to refuse a permit. The refusal of that permit actually limited a person's constitutional rights. So in the end, what the court found in the Darwood matter was that it wasn't the delegation that was unconstitutional. It was the fact that there was no guidance given. So it was a broad discretion without any guidance to the officials on how to go about when they limit it. So it is not, so that is what I'm saying. It is not correct to say that you cannot delegate the power to limit rights. It is that when you delegate that power to limit rights, you must make sure that there is clear guidance. So that is what the court indicated in Darwood. So it says we must not lose sight of the fact that the rights enshrined in the Bill of Rights must be protected and may not be unjustifiably infringed. It is for the legislature to ensure that when necessary, guidance is provided as to when that limitation of rights will be justifiable. And where appropriate, by a legislative requirement that delegated legislation be properly enacted by a competent authority. So in other words, if you delegate, you need to give that proper guidance. The next matter, Affordable Medicines Trust versus the Minister of Health, dealt with the discretion given to the Director General to prescribe conditions on which licenses may be issued. And it indicated that in this case, the court said that delegation must not be so broad or vague that the authority to whom the power is delegated is unable to determine the nature and scope of the powers that are so conferred, because that may lead to an arbitrary exercise. If you give discretionary powers and they are broad, there must be some constraint on the exercise of that power. And these constraints will generally appear from the provisions of the empowering statute as well as the policies and objectives of the empowering statute. So in other words, this speaks again to that first case where the court said when you delegate, what the minister must do must be done within the framework of a statute. You can't allow the minister to go outside of the statute and do his own thing. So that is what the court case there indicated. The next slide discusses the matter of Reserve Bank versus Shuttleworth. Now in this case, it related to exit charges. And the court considered, well, it was very broad discretionary powers that were given to the minister. And in fact, the court found that it was necessary to give such broad discretionary powers to the minister, because it was necessary for the flexible, speedy, and expert approach to exchange control. What the court indicated here is that, first off, of course, that Parliament is entitled to delegate subordinate legislation, and the power that was given is to impose conditions for the export of capital. And to that end, the minister then set this exit charge. But if you look at the trail from the legislation to the regulations, to implementation, you could see a clear line. So in other words, the minister acted within the act, within the framework of the act. And what the court indicated is that if you, because of the nature of this and how important the subject matter was, it was necessary that these regulations, the power was given. And he's saying it might be unusually wide, but it is unusual because it meets unusual circumstances. Then the court just referred also to the Darwood case to say we must recognize that this court's treatment in Darwood of broad discretionary powers by legislation was measured and nuanced. It did not hold that all wide legislative discretion is inconsistent with the constitutional norm. So that is why I'm saying we cannot simply take all of these cases, pull these terms from them and say, oh, these are now the general rules that must be applied. You still need to consider the facts of each case to understand what was being said. If I can then, on the next slide, I give a discussion of this constitutional concern. And first off, if we look back in history, pre-1994, there wasn't a constitution. Parliament was sovereign. which meant that Parliament could do whatever it liked. So if it delegated the power to amend or repeal, that was fine, because Parliament had that power. Since 1994, you have that limitation, that there's a constitution that is now sovereign, and you need to make sure that whatever you do, whether you are Parliament or not, is in line with that constitution. So the first thing is, if Parliament delegates plenary power, in other words, the power to amend or to make legislation, you ignore the principle of separation of powers, which is something that really forms the crux of our constitution, that check and balance that the three arms actually provide for each other. Further, you might find that your executive introduces matters into law that are quite contentious without involvement of the public, because there isn't a constitutional requirement on the executive to the extent that there is on Parliament. Now, if we look at the court cases that were discussed, the first, the Eastern Cape, Western Cape matter, the Executive Council Western Cape matter, it was a clear case where plenary power was delegated. No doubt, the President could amend the Act. In Justice Alliance, that was the Constitution required an Act of Parliament to actually extend the term of office. Then converse, if we look at the Reserve Bank matter, the facts of the case justified a broad discretion being delegated. And the court stressed that the Darwood case, where it required guidelines, did not say that all broad discretions would be unconstitutional. So my point is that we need to consider, keep in mind all the principles, but you still need to consider each case on its own facts. You cannot have a blanket approach. And that is my concern with both Advocate Trengo's opinion, as well as the opinions from National Treasury and DTI that also spoke to constitutionality. And that is that it seems that they are simply saying, we're applying a blanket approach, and what you are doing here is you're allowing the minister to amend or develop legislation. And I'm not sure that I agree with that. If our line between legislation and our regulation and our implementation is clear, as was stated in one of the cases, Reserve Bank, then the delegated legislation will pass constitutional muster. But that having been said, so first off, I am of the view that our bill is constitutional. I disagree with Advocate Trengov. But I must also point out that there are views that these clauses might be unconstitutional. And if these clauses were something that formed the crux of this bill, for like the our retrospective clause does, I would have advised this committee, I'm willing to certify, let someone take us on and let them go and prove that this is unconstitutional. But neither of these two clauses form the crux of this bill. This bill will not be less without those clauses. And I will now explain on the next slide why I say that. And because that is so, and because we can achieve the same result through other means, my recommendation would be that we amend the sunset clause and that we delete the clause dealing with the prescribed measures. So in other words, the actual making of regulations that would constitute debt relief measures. On the next slide, I specifically talk to the sunset clause. Now, first off, the sunset clause and the reason for the extension was just to make it easier. The committee at this point in time, I mean, already we have the view that it is in fact constitutional. We have a thesis of Coetzee, which indicated that what our bill is actually doing is addressing a gap, something that is unfair discrimination. And so we could go for a full term, but the committee also listened to what the public was saying and is concerned about the possible impact of such an extinguishing measure. And because of that, we have limited it. But now, if the measure is successful, we see the impact is this really is working. It's quite clear that we can see a positive change. Then there are other ways for that for the measure to be extended. For instance, we already have the the department doing a review of the Act, they can, with their review, bring an extension of that clause already. Another possibility is, and that is my recommendation, that we amend the sunset clause so that we require the minister to do an impact assessment and then 36 months after this has started to table that report in Parliament, and then the committee who considers that report at that time could do a committee bill. And that committee bill will not look like this committee bill. If we limit it to one clause, in other words, you extend the operation maybe for 3 or 4 years or even for 10 years, depending on what we could see from the impact, I do not see that bill taking longer than 4 months to pass through both houses. So clearly there will be enough time. And because of that, I'm saying we do not have to delegate this power to the minister. I'm of the view it's constitutional. But why open our bill up to that risk? Because there are views that it isn't. There are other ways of addressing it. So my recommendation would be that our sunset clause is amended. Rather that we delegate something to the minister, we require the minister to table a report in Parliament, and Parliament can then at that stage decide, you know, do we extend, do we not extend. In respect of the prescribing a debt intervention measure, this is on the next page. If the decision of the committee is to retain it, I will be able to certify the bill as constitutional, because I'm of the view that it is an implementation clause and not an amendment clause. However, we need to then look at a couple of things, because Advocate Trenkov also does make valid points. For instance, it was never the intention of this committee that someone who owns R1 million worth of houses and cars, etc., who is retrenched, should suddenly fall within this measure. That was never the intention. The intention was for it to be someone in the similar group of consumer that we are targeting with this bill. So we're looking someone earning 7,500 about. So after retrenchment, that probably would be zero, but we'll also not be able to even look at realizable assets, etc., etc. So you're not looking at someone who can address his bill, his debt through sequestration, for instance, etc. So we need to make sure that that is clarified. He's also talking about why do we repeat indigent, and I would suggest that we delete the word indigent because it is covered by the maximum salary of 7,500. And then the last point that he makes, and that was an oversight from my side, and I do apologize. When we did our first draft, and it was all part of one chapter, we made it very clear that the minister is limited to the measures in the bill. Then when I removed it and I put it under the regulations, I somewhere lost the word only. And now it seems that he can do any measure. And that was not the intention of this committee. So we'll have to make sure that it's only the measures in this bill that the minister can prescribe. But the question then, of course, is, and I don't want to enforce my opinion on this committee. There's a senior counsel, in fact, three senior counsel that opposes me. So not that worries me as counsel, but still, it is there, and you need to apply your minds properly. But I think the question about whether it's constitutional or not hinges on whether you see it as an amendment or legislating, or if you see it as implementation within the framework of a bill. And that is where the difference lies. But if we look at the definitions, which are problematic, and we know that they are problematic because the definitions don't say more than what we know the words mean, and actually from drafting conventions, we should not even be having a definition unless it is different from the dictionary definition. So we have a problem with our definitions. Secondly, there are other ways. We can have fast-track legislation. So there are other ways of doing it. The requirements that we place on the minister will probably take the minister months to complete, all the consultations, etc., that must be done. So you're already making the tool of being an urgent tool, you're making it less effective. But then the most important thing is something that I think that we might have lost track of as our bill developed. Remember that our bill initially was a once-off measure. 5 years from now, in fact, even 1 year from now, that measure would not have been available to someone who incurred debt at that stage. It was only available to people who incurred debt in the past. So there was a need. Should something happen in the future, then we need to have some kind of measure created. But because of this consultation, of the consultations that this committee has done, the decision was that we can't have this measure like this. You need something that is more permanent. So if we look at what the minister can do, if we limit it to people who earn up to 7,500 rand, whether they're retrenched, whether it's whatever other reason, whether there's a significant exogenous shock to the economy, whether there's a natural disaster, if you are limited to 7,500 rand income, you will qualify for the current existing debt relief measure. So in other words, our regulation clause has become superfluous. It is already provided for in our measure, because our measure is now longer term. The regulation, in other words, is in fact no longer necessary. What we had the regulation because we could foresee in the future there would not be this measure, but now our measure is there. It will be there for these people. So my recommendation is that, like I say, for a number of reasons, the method that we've placed on the minister, making it not an effective urgency tool, the issue of not being able to really define and limit those circumstances, and lastly, the fact that I cannot see the minister ever making these regulations because the debt relief measure is already available, is the reason why I would recommend to this committee that we delete the clause in the regulation the regulations clause, not all the regulations. The regulation on financial literacy, the regulation on increasing the amount and, of income and debt for the longer term measure, I would recommend still remain. They are still valid. But the portion of the regulations that deals with prescribed debt relief, I would recommend that be deleted. Then lastly, the last two slides dealing specifically with the opinion are more specific things that Council pointed out. And I would like to discuss it with the committee because it deals with his last paragraph, paragraph 50. He gives quite harsh criticism against our bill, talking about it being extremely complex, bearing the hallmarks of patchwork drafting made up as we go. It's a bill, he says, that's hard to decipher and understand and replete with inconsistencies, omissions and vaguenesses. Now, I have engaged him on this and I've asked what does he exactly mean by this. So the inconsistencies, the omissions, the vagueness that he refers to, I will take you through those now and indicate why I don't agree that they are inconsistencies. What he has indicated to me is that he only focused on the clauses that affected his opinion. So he did not look at the bill, the whole bill in context. So we need to keep that in mind. I do agree with him that it is a complex bill. Unfortunately, that is how it works with an amendment bill especially. You are bound by the style of the Principal Act that you're dealing with. And also when I asked him about the issue of the patchwork and the makeup as you go, he was saying that he would have preferred for this measure to be in a separate chapter. Now, we had that in draft 5. And then the committee was criticized by the public for creating something new and not using existing measures. So then, because actually it wasn't something new, because we actually in that chapter, we took from the existing act, I copied from there, I pasted into the chapter, and I simply amended it so that it doesn't say debt review, but it says debt relief, and things like that. So it was absolutely the act repeated in the part. But people couldn't see that it was simply the act repeated in the part. So to take that perception away, we then broke that part up, and we then slotted it into the act. Now, unfortunately, an amendment act then does come across as patchwork. That is unfortunately the the negative thing of an amendment act is that it's very difficult to read, because you need to read it in conjunction with your principal act. Otherwise, it simply does not make sense. But I want to specifically on slide 12, the one thing that it indicated as being an inconsistency is where he says there appears to be a contradiction in respect of the maximum for the total unsecured debt. But there is no contradiction. If you read the whole bill in context, you will see that Section 86A sets the current maximum for all debt intervention applicants. So this includes the ones that will come for a debt review type of process with the NCR and will be repaying. There will be restructuring of their debt. But it also applies to those applicants who cannot restructure their debt and for whom the debt will be suspended. The difference is, because the one is a longer term measure, the minister may raise that maximum. But for those who will be part of the extinguishing process, the minister cannot raise that because it's a limited period that is. So if you don't read the regulations clause specifically with this, yes, I can see that you think that there's an inconsistency. But if you read the bill in context, it is not. This is, in fact, then a requirement for all debt intervention applicants, but it's just that it can be adjusted for some and not for the extinguishing candidates. The next concern, that was in paragraph 5 of his opinion. Paragraph 6 of his opinion, he says, it doesn't make sense for the debtor to be over-indebted to qualify, but then you declare them over-indebted. It seems to not talk to each other. Now, the thing is that we mirror the wording currently of the existing debt review clause in the Act. So, there it talks about having the consumer declared over-indebted. And then, if you read further on, it says the debt counsellor must reject the application if the consumer is not over-indebted. So in other words, it is a bit of a contradiction, but that is currently how the Act reads. So it is something that has been working. Everyone understands what is meant by it. You must be over-indebted in order to qualify, is actually what it says. Then if that is confirmed through the application process, through the evaluation process, there will be a formal declaration of that over-indebtedness, because that will then inform the restructuring of your debt. So again, there isn't an inconsistency. It is in fact just the current wording of the Act that is repeated. Then in paragraph 7 and 8, he indicates that we are understating the duties of the regulator. Now, the draft 5 of our bill was criticized for being too operational. We set out what everyone must do. So we changed that slightly, took away some of the specific forms that must be submitted and what they must look like, etc., etc. And we copied 100% Section 86, which also does not state all the duties of a debt counsellor. Now, it is acceptable for an act not to be, you can include the operational issues. It's not that you can't, but it's acceptable for it not to include it. And in fact, departments, I think in fact it was the regulator and the tribunal themselves who were concerned about how operational our bill was, because it makes it very difficult for them to slightly change how they do things. You know, we say you must do this first and then this and then this, and then they find something else works better and they can't change it. The next paragraph, also the same issue, talking about how will the tribunal be hearing and determining the second suspension referral. Again, that is an operational issue. We indicate that there could be, the tribunal will then in their rules provide for how that will be done. The next is in paragraph 20 of his opinion. He indicates that okay, this is something different. I just want to park that and I will get back to it. Paragraph 21, he indicates that it's not clear who will gather information that the tribunal must consider when suspending or extinguishing debt. And again, I'm saying this is an operational issue. The rules of the tribunal will assist and say, look, for us to get this information, this is what we need. So who will be the best person to put that before us? And then that is where the guidance will come from that. And then lastly, the issue of paragraph 50, the patchwork drafting. As I've indicated, that the part that we had in draft 5, and we had to break that up and put it in a proper amendment bill, if I can put it like that, where you amend a number of sections. So I do not, I understand what he is saying, but I think that if he read the bill in context, he would have understood that there are some limits in how we draft amendment bills. The last aspect that I just want to point out in paragraph 20, he asks simply the question whether the rehabilitation clause is really necessary, given that our maximum suspension period is 12 months. Now again, we came down from I think about 3 or 4 years where your right to apply for credit would have been suspended to a period of 6 months and then a discretionary 6 months. So I suppose the question could now arise, do we really feel that it's necessary for rehabilitation? But that is not something that will affect the constitutionality of the bill. It is simply a policy decision for the committee to consider if this is still something that we feel is necessary to have in the bill. The big decisions that I do require from the committee, and because of the opinion, is firstly whether clause 13 regarding the sunset clause, this is on slide 14, could be amended so that instead of giving the minister the right to extend the measure, we require the minister to submit an impact assessment in Parliament, and Parliament can then decide what to do with it. So that is the first proposal that I need a decision on. The next is on clause 29, which deals with regulations. And I'm recommending that the power to make regulations that prescribe the debt intervention measure be deleted. And the reason for that is that there are already provision made for it in our bill. And the last decision then is just the issue of rehabilitation. And I'm saying it's a totally a policy decision. If it is deleted because it's now 6 or 12 months maximum that you'll be limited, perhaps it isn't necessary to complicate the bill with that kind of clause. Thank you, Chairperson. That is all from me on the opinion.
Thank you very much, Advocate van der Merwe. I think certainly all of us, I'm sure, committee members have studied the legal opinion. However, the way you took us through, I think, made it far more comprehensible to all of us. It may be useful at this point. Should we go straight into the DTI? Now, I'm just looking at members, perhaps we can, but I see a couple of hands going up and we need to entertain those. I'll start with the first hand. It's yourself, Honourable Esterhazen, Honourable MacPherson, right? So, and then an Honourable, yes, now I saw that, Honourable Kacharia.
Madam Chair, thank you. As much work as what Advocate van der Merwe has put into this, I think at the end of the line, the thing is, we must establish whether the debt is completely going to be written off, where it should be restructured, or what write-off should be complicated, and why was it originally then given to people who can't afford it. I can't really think that financial institutions who's already, South African, whole economy hinges on spending, and it's a problem at all. So everyone wants credit, and credit is very expensive. For me, for the banks, this is, to have this bill and this policy just before elections, things is, doesn't just seem right to me. How can a bank, as a financial institution,
Let's just respect the speaker.
How can a bank give you a credit light or credit rating? They give you say 11.5% and the prime is 10.2% or whatever. Where do they get that money from? I get it that from the poorest people. The good clients will never get some money. We debt counseling come at a high cost and debt restructure. And it's usually a shock for people that do debt counseling and things when they get to the cost of all this. And I'm really concerned of that the poor and the most fragile people is even going to suffer more through this debt counseling. Thank you.
The Honourable Esterhazen. Honourable MacPherson.
Thank you, Chair. Good to be back. Good to see everyone again. Advocate, I have immense respect for you. I think that you're probably one of the most learned legal minds that I've come across in a long while. But I do want to disagree with you on a number of points. Having read the opinion of senior counsel, and having also gone through the public submissions that have come through, there's one thing that concerns me greatly, and you've said it yourself a number of times this afternoon, that senior counsel's opinion is based on two or findings is based on two clauses and not in the bill in its entirety. And that's where I want to really pause for reflection. Because right now we still don't know, outside of your own opinion, your stated opinion, advocate, on whether the bill in its entire reading, in its entire application, is constitutional. Now, I am very quickly leaning towards my views that there are persistent problems within the bill. I think that certainly it is welcomed that there's a view that the minister's powers or abilities to prescribe debt intervention should be curtailed, reduced, or in fact withdrawn. I support that particular view. But when it comes to your views on, well, you know, how do we operationalize aspects of the bill, I'm not sure that's something that we can just sort of outsource to the NCT or the NCR. Because what we know from historically is that the worst legislation is legislation that cannot be implemented. In fact, that is not my view, but that is a view that has been shared by people in your own party, as well, no less than your former Secretary General. And the former Secretary General.
Moment, let's not have dialogue.
Yeah.
On the floor.
Yeah, and in fact, his words, to paraphrase, were one of the biggest failures of government have been the inability to implement legislation, and that is because of the of legislation that was just simply unimplementable from the beginning. So I think that, advocate, with respect, that those are concerns which senior counsel themselves recognise. How does the NCT operationalise these points, or the NCR? What I do want to add is, you know, I think it's very difficult to get lawyers to agree on anything, to be perfectly frank. But when three senior counsel agree on substantive points, that tends to raise a flag, a red flag, to say that there's something that we should pause and reflect on. and where are we headed with this bill? Are we sticking to the true mandate that we agreed on in the House? Are there ways in which we can make the bill easily more readable or better understood by the general public? And let's not forget, Chair, we're not making legislation for ourselves to understand, and you know, we may be considered more learned than the people that this may apply to. And then just a question directly to you, Chair. How do we interact or engage on the public submissions with the advocate? At what point will we get to go through that particular submission? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable McPherson. Honourable Kachalia.
Thank you, Chair. I must say I share the concerns expressed by my colleagues here. It seems to me that there are two real questions which we are attempting to answer here. One, in terms of this, is it a plenary power that's being delegated, is the one question, and the other is public involvement and procedural probity potentially being bypassed? So in view of this, the question is, does prescribing a debt intervention measure by the minister and the extension of the operational period of the measure, i.e. the sunset clause, fall potentially foul of our constitution? Now that's an extraordinary serious framing of the questions there, because if it doesn't pass constitutional muster in this regard, then we are barking up some crazy tree. Now, Advocate Wim Trengrove, Senior Counsel, says yes, this is a real concern. Two other senior counsels says yes, this is a real concern. The DTI says yes, this is a real concern. And Treasury says yes, this is a real concern. Now, Advocate van der Merwe appears to be here, and with respect, the lone voice, in this regard. And despite her defense of her stance, she now says that she's going to suggest that we amend the sunset clause and delete the minister's prescription. Now, I'd still like to see this amended version being given to the various advocates, Wim Trengrove in particular, whom I respect enormously, for review, given the serious constitutional implications hereof. And also, I'd urge members to take serious cognizance of Advocate Trengrove's comments in terms of paragraph 20, 21, and 50, which are reflective of how we've drafted this bill in its entirety. I thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Kachalia. Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Chair. I just want to say thank you to Advocate van der Merwe for her input. I don't honestly believe that the opinion that was given, even though it might say it's unconstitutional for the minister to have the powers to bring in extra new measures, debt intervention measures, I'm of the opinion that the Constitution is there to protect our people. And if there is some circumstance where people find themselves either the massive retrenchment takes place or a natural disaster takes place, if we remove this clause from the legislation and we say in the event that that does happen, we'll let Parliament decide whether or not there should be some debt intervention for those people that have suffered this shock, I think that the problem there could be, as we all know, how long it takes Parliament to get anything done. By the time we've done this intervention from Parliament's side, those people will be completely destroyed, financially destroyed, and that is why that those sections were put into the bill, so that if there is an extraordinary circumstance where thousands and thousands of people are affected by a natural disaster or a massive retrenchment, then instantaneous action can be taken by government to alleviate those people's suffering. And that's why I think that that clause should stay inside the bill. And we should test it constitutionally, because what do we do in that circumstance? I mean, let's say we remove that clause, and in the future something does happen. They're going to say, well, what did government do about it? And we'll say, well, we had to take it out. It was unconstitutional. So I do support that that clause stays in there. I'm not saying it should be removed. I think it should stay there in order to address the problem of people that will run into crisis in a natural disaster or something like that. Thank you.
Honourable Williams, is there anyone else who wishes to comment on the section here? Yes, Honourable Mantash.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I want to correct my learned friend, Honourable Kachalia. When he says we're enacting this bill because we're going for elections, maybe it is because we have a different constituency with him.
Just that they diagonally apart. Look,
I think we
yeah, no. I don't think it's a matter of debate. Right.
We initiated the bill long before we knew there would be elections, because our people are always affected by other retrenchments and unemployment for quite some time, and they can't afford the kind of debt. And we also considered that some of our aged people are given loans by loan sharks, yet they only depend on their pension grant. That's the basis of why we enacted the bill. So I don't want us to go that far to say it is done because there's election coming. That's the only portion I wanted to talk on. Otherwise, Chairperson, I agree with what Honourable Williams is saying. Thank you very much.
I'm first dealing with the first, what we asked for a brief comment on or clarification. Then I will take other comments. Is there anyone else who wishes to comment on this? I think, did you have your, I see two hands up. Yeah, Honourable Buyani.
Chairperson, thanks. Maybe on clarity, I request the advocate to elaborate on the section 86A, the clause which what informs, because we must be able to be informed in terms of the decision taking on this one. Mm-hmm. Because you spoke of inconsistency, omission, and the unconditionality. So if you can elaborate on the matter so that you are informed. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honourable Khudebe.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think, first of all, we will have to appreciate the input made by the advocate. I think that is very incisive, and then it's providing a clear direction in which this thing must deal with. But it's a fact that our constitution is also providing for social economic rights. When people are assuming in debt whereby they are not going to be able to realize their potential because of being trapped by debt, it's also a problem. So that's why the issue of parliament of the people must be able to intervene. But these issues which are raised by the legal opinions of the other people must also be taken into consideration. I think that as the committee, we must move very carefully so that we ensure that at the end of the day, we don't want a bill which is going to be contested in court. We see where we can compromise together upon. But the issue is that the very same constitution provide for social economic rights of the people. So when the people are no longer going to be able to participate in the economy because of the debt they cannot deal with, what must we do? Must the parliament sit back and do nothing? I think that it will be an insult to the crafters of our constitution. Because if you can look, just not going to look only at a certain clause, look at the constitution at its entirety, you can see that it protects the most vulnerable too. So, Chair, I'll also appreciate that if we can deal with this input, with the input from the department, let's come back so that we have a thorough discussion out of that, so that we can take a resolution after. Thank you, Chair.
I was also going to propose that, yes, we want to get that further clarification from the advocate just on the one section, but we do want to also hear from the DDG before actually totally unpacking things and getting further engagement from committee members. Although I am compelled to make one comment, because this has come up more than six times in the last year, this year. And that is, this is an election bill. The decision was taken 3 years ago when many of the members sitting here were not members of this committee. And it was a unanimously adopted position by a full committee before being taken to the House. So, the fact of the matter is, yes, there are elections every 5 years. That's a reality. So 3 years ago is closer to it not being election time than it being election time. So let us leave that matter alone. But I do agree that there is a great need for us to deal with the substantive issues. And I would like, with members' permission, just to get the short clarification sought on that one area, and then to go immediately on, no engagement, onto the DDG. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. If we look at the bill itself, Section 86A, it's on page 13, it says that a debt intervention applicant may apply to the National Credit Regulator in the prescribed manner and form to have the debt intervention applicant declared over-indebted. If that debt intervention applicant has a total unsecured debt owing to credit providers of no more than 50,000 or such an amount as may be prescribed by Section 171. That's in the actual draft. So, in other words, what it says here is that a debt intervention applicant, and then we must look at the definition of a debt intervention applicant, may apply in a prescribed manner or form only if that debt intervention applicant has a total unsecured debt of no more than 50,000. If we look at the definitions, a debt intervention applicant on page 4 of the bill is a natural person or natural persons who own a joint estate, who on the date of the submission of the application for debt intervention is a consumer under unsecured credit agreements, receives no income, or on an average for the 6 months preceding the date of the application had income that did not exceed 7,500. So those are your requirements in order to apply. That's the first step. There's no doubt about it. Doesn't matter which way your application is going to go, those are the requirements. Then what we say further in subsection 12, we say subsection 6E, and 6E deals with the referral where the debt intervention applicant does not solve within 5 years. In other words, they cannot repay their debts. That section will only be applicable to a debt intervention applicant who does not earn more than 7,500 and if the total unsecured debt is no more than 50,000. And the reason for that is because we then allow the minister in the regulations clause, clause 29 on page 34, and it is currently subsection 2B on page 36. We allow the minister to adjust the amount contemplated in section 1, the 7,500, and we allow the minister in paragraph B to adjust the amount of qualifying total unsecured debt. So in other words, if you read this regulations clause with section 86A1, that could change for a person who just applies for this debt intervention. But if you are a candidate if the National Credit Regulator considers referring someone to the tribunal for suspension of the credit agreements or extinguishing, then should it happen that the minister have upped that amount, those candidates that are higher than the 7,500 may not be so referred. It will only be people who earn up to 7,500 and the debt is no more than 50,000. The minister cannot adjust those amounts. So that is what the difference is there, and why I'm saying there isn't an inconsistency, but you need to read the regulations clause with this clause.
Thank you very much, Advocate van der Merwe. And now if we can immediately go on to Dr. Masocha.
Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon, honorable members, to my colleagues from the NCR, NCT, Advocate van der Merwe, and to other stakeholders in the room. Our presentation as the DTI is on the submissions that we have received from the stakeholders. We did receive 10 credit industry stakeholders submissions that were provided by the committee. They were addressing the clauses that were advertised. Three clauses were advertised. It was the clause 12B that looks at the powers of the courts to reduce interest rates, charges and fees. And then clause 29A on the funding for financial literacy and capability programs. And clause 29B and the new subsection 2A and 2B looking at the adjustments of the gross income and then the adjustments to the total unsecured debt. What we have done is in our response, we consolidated the responses. We also provided a matrix where we put all the main issues provided, and we grouped them because some of them were more or less similar to ensure that we have a comprehensive approach to them. And so we will be focusing on the main pertinent issues. The other issues that were overall about the bill, we looked at them, but we will give an overall view on them at the end, but the main focus is on what was advertised. In terms of the summarized views from the publics regarding the clause 12B, regarding the reduction of the interest and fees, the comments that came are as follows. There was a proposal that this clause should not be enacted and it must be removed in its entirety, and that there is a voluntary debt restructuring mechanism that is currently in place, referred to as the task team agreement, which includes concession rules agreed to by credit providers. And also there was a concern that there should be guidance provided for debt counselors and the NCR on the reduction of interest fees and charges, and that the courts must also be given guidance on how to exercise these powers. And there was also a concern that this provision is not restricted to credit agreement types or the quantum of the credit agreements. And overall, there was an issue around the unintended consequences of this proposal, this clause. And so this came from the various stakeholders. So that's why we grouped it, because it was more or less on the same approach to this issue. And our response is that if you look at the current gaps that were also highlighted by the legal opinion and by the presentation by the advocate, there is a gap. And the use of the current mechanism, the task team agreement that they are referring to as a concession, it's voluntary and it's currently having a minimal effect. In fact, it is not even being used in the industry widely. So let's say on average 18% of the industry is currently using this voluntary mechanism, and because it's voluntary, it cannot be binding. So because they're not binding, so they are not even taken seriously, which affects the impact, meaning that as a proposal for our intervention, this will not work. And we are also saying that we do acknowledge that there is a need to prescribe or determine a criteria to guide the reductions in the regulation, meaning that there must be a guidance provided around this area. So on that one, we agree with them. And also to say that the criteria must also include a determination for the affordability, and that every credit agreement must be treated differently. So the concern that there will be zero-rated percentages should not be taken to the extreme, because every case will be treated in its own merit, and it might be that it does not even get to the zero-rated percentages. And we also say that the interest rates on mortgages, mortgage agreements, should ideally not be reduced to zero in that process, and that they should also be included in the restructuring. And we want to highlight that there will not be an automatic zero percentage interest. So the concern that this may be abused is not going to be there. We're saying that it will not happen because there will be guidelines around this. And in terms of the unintended consequences to be mitigated, we are saying that with the guidelines that will be provided, the unintended consequences will be addressed. And we are also saying that for credit providers, when you have a client or a consumer who's not able to pay, a zero rate is beneficial for the credit providers rather than them not receiving any payments for their credit. So it is not the worst case scenario for them. There was also comments regarding the powers and the role of the NCR in this regard, that the NCR is the, we are saying that it is the only entity that can process debt intervention applications, and that this places them in a conflicting role of being a regulator and a registrant at the same time in cases where a repayment plan is possible. And also there was a concern that the courts should not be allowed to exercise broad and unrestricted powers in respect of the credit agreements between credit providers and consumers without the appropriate guidance and criteria. And to the two points, what we are saying is that we do not see the conflict between the, there's no conflict of interest in the role of the NCR undertaking debt intervention, because there is a process, and the NCR will not be making decisions per se, but they will be processing and making recommendations. And in addition, they will be doing this at no cost to the consumer, unlike in the normal debt review process. So we see them as bringing a better solution that addresses a need and a gap that is existing currently. And the NCR will minimize the cost of debt intervention for the consumers. And this is in the spirit of the legislation that we have currently in front of us, to ensure that the gap, that gap in the market, that gap that has been there for many years, that is also a constitutional challenge, will be addressed. And regarding the discretions of the court, our view is that the discretion of the courts should be respected. And we do note that we do need the guidelines that will assist in terms of how these reductions should be managed. So it won't be a blanket approach that is not guided at all. Then we move to the next clause, that is clause 29A on the funding of financial literacy. And the overall comments that came on this one, for instance, is that the credit, the lending, the over-indebtedness levy to be charged in addition to the existing monthly service fee to fund a debt intervention program under the existing debt counseling infrastructure for the lower income population and assist in the funding of the financial literacy and capability program. And also that the bank CETA in conjunction with credit providers has done extensive work on financial literacy and will be the perfect entity to assist in this regard. Also that debt counselors could also be trained to provide financial literacy coaching while reviewing consumer standing. What was concerning about these comments was how none of the submissions took into account the fact that we are talking about over-indebted consumers who currently do not even have ways or means to pay their own debt. the solutions and the proposals they were bringing to the table was giving the burden back to consumers without saying that as the industry we can do the following. It was more of saying that look for ways as government, look for ways as consumers to address the financial literacy funding. And we noted that with serious concern as a collective. And what we are saying here is that we are not in support of the proposal to burden over-indebted consumers further by the imposition of a levy. Because this levy that was proposed is supposed to come from the consumers. And we are also concerned that it will lead to the possibility of abuse where this proposal is accepted. For instance, one of them was even saying that this money should be taken from the debit orders of consumers and credit agreements. So that's where we see the potential abuse for the consumers. And in addition, we are saying that the levy must be on credit providers if there would be any levy. And we do know that the issue of the levy is not under discussion per se, but we're saying if we were to entertain the views from the public, the opposite should actually be the case, rather than the consumers being the ones to bear the brunt of the cost. And in fact, this is the approach in other jurisdictions, like the United Kingdom model, that legislation imposes a levy, and it has been the case post the 2008-09 financial crisis on the industry. And regarding the other measures by other institutions, like your bank CETA on the literacy and financial education for consumers, we are saying that the existing mechanisms are not enough, and they only address a particular niche market outside the target this bill intends to reach. So there are programs, there are literacy programs, but they are not talking to our specific target group. And we think that they also have a subjective approach to debt relief. For example, in terms of the promotion of voluntary surrender, not debt review per se. And we are proposing that material should be ideally intended to the consumers catered for in the bill. So the proposals that were made in the submissions were not necessarily talking to our specific need. They were highlighting solutions and proposals, but we felt that they are not sufficient. So more is still required, hence this provision is quite important. And Clause 29B talks to the minister's powers to adjust the gross income and the maximum debt. So the next one talks to the maximum debt. And this was talking to the powers of the ministers. So the concern that the minister will be granted very wide powers may include a much greater number of consumers and agreements in the debt intervention process without having to consult with the industry stakeholders. And also that there is no objective factors to assist the minister in determining what will make a consumer an economically viable client for a debt canceller. And also they raised the point that they are not in support of the minister being empowered to adjust the amounts for the intervention applicant, as it will create long-term uncertainty and instability in the credit market. And also that the right extended to the minister the right must also talk to other circumstances, like when there are changes in the repo rates and the prime lending rate. And we are saying that we do acknowledge that when the minister does make regulations, a consultation process is binding on the minister in making the regulation. It's a normal course of the law. And that an economically viable client ought to be determined through a thorough assessment and research in consultation with all the stakeholders. And we are also saying that the authority of the minister has already been decided upon. So this issue of the powers of the minister was being conflicted in terms of they brought up the wider powers of the minister over and above the advertised clauses. So in this one, we're just clarifying that the powers of the ministers were restricted to the clauses that were advertised. So the other issues were already dealt with by the committee. And we were also saying that the other factors that they were referring to, normally when we do our regulations, we look at them. For instance, your adjustments, the economic factors, and so on. And the concern that these the changes will be approached haphazardly, we are saying that these will not be approached retrospectively, and there won't be sudden changes, and the changes that will occur will be consulted upon and published as the norm when it comes to amending the regulations. And this was the these are the main issues around that. And in terms of the general observations we've made, is that although the committee has opened this up for the specific clauses advertised, the stakeholders went into various other issues in the bill that were not really advertised. So we want to just say that so that it does not appear as though we ignored the other views that were presented by the submissions. We were focusing only on the advertised clauses, hence the specific responses. But overall, in terms of the clause 12A, the stakeholders did not support this. They're saying that there's a lack of clarity and guidance on the manner in which the reductions will be done, and that they propose that guidance be provided in the regulations through consultations with industry and also based on the task team agreement. And then on the clause 29A, there was a general support for this clause, although there was no clarity regarding the funding model. And this is where the proposals were made regarding the role of the consumers and government in funding for the financial literacy process. And we are saying that we propose that the costs, if any, be borne by the credit providers rather than the consumers. And Clause 29B was also not supported by stakeholders due to the minister being granted very wide powers, which might be exercised without consultation with the industry stakeholders. And the minister is compelled, in our view, to consult by law when making any regulation, and that the minister will undertake the necessary research, consider relevant factors, and consult the industry in the formulation of the regulations as contemplated. And we, as a collective, we support the specific sections that are under discussion, and we ask the committee to consider and further deliberate on them. We think that they will go a long way in providing an accessible and viable credit market for our poor consumers. There was a concern raised around the wide consultation of the clauses that were advertised. And some of the stakeholders were advising that perhaps this should be opened up for a wider consultation in the Gazette, in the Government Gazette. And we thought that we should bring this to the committee as a concern that was raised in case the bill is challenged on the basis that for this advertisement process, sufficient consultation did not take place. So overall, Chair, these were the main issues. Other issues that were raised were noted. However, to speak to the specific clauses, this is how far that the process went for us. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much, DDG. I think what has happened is that the advocate, Vanda Merwe, has also looked at the same issues, and it would be, and I'm looking at members, I think it's going to be more constructive, having heard the DG, for the advocate to immediately come in this area, because there were one or two comments and statements made by the DDG, she may hold a different legal interpretation on that. So let us go ahead with that. Are you ready then, Advocate Vanda Merwe? Right. And then will proceed with our engagement, all right? Looking at members, because I know there's not much oxygen in the room, but you know, soon it'll be tea. Honourable Mantash.
Thank you, Chairperson. We appreciate the presentation by the DDG. I just want to remind the committee, Chair, that our visit, our study tour, revealed that in other countries, a levy is borne by the service providers, not the consumers, and therefore would support the proposal by the DDG. Thank you, Chair.
That is worth reiterating as we go through to the engagement. It is a pertinent point. Thank you. Advocate van der Merwe.
Thank you, Chairperson and members. The presentations to members, I'm now on slide 16. So I'll deal with clause 12B first, the powers of the court to reduce the interest rates. What I did was to first look at who supported the clause and who raised concerns. So this was supported by Black Sash, Gusata and Dikasa. And concerns were raised related to deprivation of property, affecting the sanctity of contracts, the fact that a lack of guidance may result in all debt rearrangements being at zero interest. It will apply to all over-indebted consumers. It may result in changing lending practices. There was a concern about credit life insurance that might be lost if it is part of reduced costs. Will the consumer be able, after 5 years, to pay an increased interest? What about the voluntary agreed to restructuring rules? And then there was a reference to a court case, First Rand Bank versus Brand, which stated that the debt rearrangement order cannot and does not extinguish underlying contractual obligations by lowering interest rates and other charges. On the next slide, I then discuss these concerns. On slide 17. So would this constitute deprivation? Yes, I do think it would constitute deprivation. But is it arbitrary? First off, we know that this is a law of general application. So we have established that. Is it a fair process? Yes, because what we have here is not just something that happens before a magistrate and the magistrate decides by him or herself that I will now be lowering interest rates. There is first, in terms of Section 86 and 87, a proposal from a debt counsellor. In other words, there was a whole debt review process that took place, and then the debt counsellor makes a proposal. The court then must conduct a hearing. There isn't an option not to conduct a hearing. The court must conduct a hearing and must consider all information before it, as well as the consumer's financial means, prospects, and obligations. So, in other words, this is not something that will happen in a vacuum. The court will have to ask for information to make sure that the court has sufficient information to be able to reduce the interest rate. From the department side, there was a proposal for guidelines to be prescribed by regulations. That is something that we'll simply have to add to Section 171 because the Act doesn't currently sufficiently provide for the minister to prescribe something like that. It's not that big of a problem. It is something that we can quickly add. The next question, of course, is if there is sufficient reason. And in fact, if we read First Rand Bank versus Brandt, the court said that the reason why it cannot lower the interest rates is because there is no provision for the court, who is a creature of statute, to do so. In other words, the court is limited by what acts allow it to do. And if the Act does not allow it to lower interest rate, it cannot do so. So in other words, is there sufficient reason? Yes, exactly. This, it must be done through legislation. It cannot just be expected from courts to do so. From DCASA, we got that the debt review concessions, despite them being in operation for over 10 years, they were saying that uptake is very low because most credit providers actually do not accept your repayment proposals, which impacts on the success of your debt review process. So if you give a court the power to reduce interest rates, you will actually be making debt review much more effective. DDI also pointed out that these are voluntary rules and not necessarily any way that you can force credit providers to actually comply with this. Then there was a recent NCT judgment, and perhaps the NCT can talk a little bit more about it, because I read it and then it makes sense and then it doesn't make sense anymore. What they say is, when a magistrate rearranges a consumer's obligations, the default is in fact cured. In other words, the charges that Section 102 of the Act imposes, I just want to look at 102 so that we know what we're talking about. These talk about initiation fees, cost of extended warranty, delivery, installation, connection fees, taxes, license or registration fees, and so on. These charges are limited from the period from the date when the default incurred up to the date when the order was issued. So it is sometimes very difficult for debt counsellors to actually check compliance to see if all the charges that Section 102 requires them to add, if that was actually included in the debt review. So if there is, as I understand it, if there is a rearrangement of the actual charges, of the actual obligations, then you stop the default and you have a specific date. And it makes it much easier. So in other words, it means that in law, we have a bit of a vacuum. And there are things that we cannot do because the Act does not allow us to. So there is, in other words, sufficient reason for this to be brought into the Act. In that, then in short, means that it will not be arbitrary deprivation. It will be something that is allowed by the Constitution. So the other concerns, if your process... like we said, if the process actually works that like we have here, you have your hearing, it will make your debt review more effective. The Act in itself says that the magistrate must conduct a hearing. But if we feel that we want to add some guidelines, we can provide for that through regulation. The issue of the credit life insurance being maybe one of the costs that are being zero rated, well, the magistrate will have to consider whether that zero rating will affect credit life insurance. And perhaps the credit life insurance should then be one of the amounts that's not zero rated. But that is something that the committee, in fact, has already highlighted, this issue of credit life insurance, as something that needs to be discussed with the insurance industry and how that can work. So that is not something that I think should stop the bill. It is a problem. It is something that must be addressed, but perhaps outside of the bill. On the next issue that I want to talk to then, the Clause 29A, the funding of the financial literacy, I'm on slide 18 of mine. This was generally supported by most. The concerns were NCR capacity, but we know about NCR capacity concerns. We know that that is going to be addressed. That is something that the NCR has and the DGI has confirmed will be done. The NCR needs capacity built. Furthermore, the cost and all of these things. Well, the NCR, it says one of the concerns was that it is a legislated responsibility of the NCR to actually educate people. But if you look at the section that we refer to, section 16, subsection 1A in the Act, not the bill, in the Act, it says the NCR must implement education measures. It does not say that it must develop them. And it is part of your development that there will be a cost. So, and in any event, the fact that the NCR must implement something does not mean that it must do so in a vacuum in regards to a budget. It is not something that happens automatically or, I don't know, by miracle almost. For the NCR to implement something, there needs to be a budget that speaks to that line item. So funding is a requirement whether the Act says it's the NCR's duty or not. Then there was a concern that our clause in our bill, which says that the minister... I just actually want to get to the bill so that I can read for you exactly what the clause says. It says... the minister must make regulations regarding participation in a financial literacy or capability program and must consult the minister responsible for finance on the funding of such a program. Now, the concern was that must consult on the funding makes this a money bill. It does not. It only provides for consultation. And what I perhaps want to explain to members so that if this criticism comes up, When we consider the money bills considered by the Standing Committee on Finance, quite often you get two bills with very similar names. It will, for instance, be, I can't remember, I'll actually open up a register and just check and give you an actual example as well. But you will get one that is classified in the end as a 75 or a 76, depending on the content of that that actual bill. And then you will get one that is classified as a money bill, the 70 semen. So, and often the one is called a Framework Act or something like that. Or an Administration Act. Because what the one does is it actually sets the scene for the money bill to be introduced. In itself, it is not a money bill. It talks about levies that will be introduced. It talks about taxes that will come. But the fact that it talks about money, the fact that it talks about, doesn't in itself make it a money bill. It will, your money bill itself is then the one that says there is now this tax and you will pay this tax. So that is a very much a different one. For instance, we have your tax administration laws amendment, and that is normally classified as the 75. And then you have your tax laws, which is actually the 77. So that is your difference. So what our bill does is it sets the scene. And that is then where it is not a money bill. It is simply talks about the scene being set for the administration. There is money going to be needed, but in itself, it does not set that actual, impose that actual tax or levy. So it is definitely not something that makes our bill a money bill. Then there were some proposals that the intervention should be available before a person actually enters the credit market. There should be intervention at the point of default, and then the levy that should be charged. But these are policy decisions. I think the DTI has already addressed them. And we must just keep in mind that the proposal from Nedbank to introduce a levy will turn our bill into a money bill. So that is actually one that we simply cannot, we're not constitutionally mandated to even consider that for our bill. What I can say about the fact of these interventions being available sooner, there are some methods, and I know that we've also said at the outset of the application, so that is the point of default. That is where there will be training at that point. So our bill does provide for that. So I think that is addressed to a great extent. My slide 20 then speaks to the adjustment of the maximum gross income figure. Just want to see. And more or less, I want to actually deal with the two slides, 20 and 21, in the same, because the concerns are very similar. The concerns were that this increase will cause uncertainty in the market. There could be an impact on creditors. The powers are too broad. 7,500 is already too high. The extinguishing of the debt is arbitrary. Other factors should be whether the consumer can repay a debt, no consultation requirements. But the clause that we're talking about here is not something that will impact creditors, credit providers at all. It will impact consumers. What we are saying is that the minister can, whenever it is necessary, when the there's enough time, inflation, etc., all the factors that we mentioned in the bill, can look at the portion of consumers who will qualify to be assisted by the NCR instead of a debt counsellor. That's it. How does that impact on a credit provider? The consumer that we look at here qualifies currently to go to a debt counsellor. That doesn't change. Now what happens is a couple of years ahead, inflation, etc., takes its toll, and the minister says, but I can see that there is now a group of consumers that again falls in a gap. They can't go to the debt counsellor, and they can't come to the NCR. And that is all that we are doing. We are just closing that gap because of inflation. So credit providers are not affected by this clause at all. Nothing. Who is affected is the NCR and government. Because now see, there might be a different group, there might be a little bit more who are affected. And it will be more costly to government. It does not affect the credit providers. So I think that credit providers perhaps misunderstood the clause. I did not perhaps specifically understand exactly what this qualification actually means. So I'm not concerned, and I do not think that there's any need for change on those matters. In respect of consultation, or perhaps if I could at this point in time just talk to, it is not something that I prepared a slide on. We received a submission from National Treasury yesterday. I did read through the submission, and unfortunately, Treasury also went broader than the call for public inputs. So the issues, they mentioned things on credit life insurance, which wasn't part of the call for comments. So I'm not even going to address those. It would not be a fair process if we allow some stakeholders to go broader and other not. Credit life insurance was hashed out by this committee. This committee sat on it. Treasury is part of the discussions, and those concerns have, in fact, been raised. What they do say is that they do propose that the debt intervention prescribed portion be deleted. Then they give a very practical input on in respect of financial literacy versus financial capability. And they say that actually the way that the definition reads, which comes from Treasury, it is almost the same thing. And they recommend we remove the word financial literacy and just keep the word financial capability. So that's a technical issue. I don't see any problem with doing that. It probably makes it much easier if you're talking about the same word rather than two words that mean different things. In respect of the courts reducing the interest and the charges, they also called for guidelines on that. So and I think that we've already dealt with. They've asked on the financial prescribing the literacy program and so on, that there should be consultation, but that our bill provides for. We say there must be consultation on the funding. Consultation on funding should, with all respect, also keep in mind any existing measures, because if there's an existing measure, then that is what you must use. Otherwise, why should it be funded for something that already exists to reinvent the wheel? And that is the only things that they commented on. So I just thought to quickly bring that in before I go over to the issue of consultation. Now, a number of submitters was concerned about the fact that the whole bill should have been advertised and not just portions of the bill. There was a concern that it was sent to a closed list of participants, but that is in fact not correct. I confirmed with Mr. Hermans, and in fact I was able to draw the invitation myself from Parliament's website. So publication was on Parliament's website, which is a forum that is accessible by the public. It is a space that the public knows they should look at to keep track of legislation. Furthermore, we need to keep in mind that this bill does not go to the President from this House. It first goes to the National Council of Provinces, and it's a 76 bill, so there's going to be very extensive consultations in a second round. But the big thing that I do want to talk about is the issue of publishing the whole bill versus publishing portions of the bill. Now, one of the submitters referred us to the matter of Truworths versus the Minister of Trade and Industry. And again, almost like a number of things where people have quoted court cases, they quote just the sentence that suits their argument. If we look at the full quote from the case, the court says, it was submitted correctly on behalf of the respondents, the Minister of Trade and Industry, that the Minister is not obliged to re-advertise for comment. However, where the Minister changes the draft regulations in a material respect, then under certain circumstances, advertising for further comment might be advisable. So what happened here is that the minister considered extensive public submissions, made changes to the regulations, added some new things to the regulations. And then what the court ended up saying was those new things, those changes, material changes, you had to republish. I also went through an exercise where I took draft 5 as it was published, and I took draft 6 as it was published, and I looked at what happened in between. And if we take them clause by clause, it is very clear that either an amendment, it's very clear, first off, that the bill was slightly reshuffled. You can see that the part E is now sections 86A, section 87A, section 88A and B. So you can see that it's a little bit differently situated in the bill. But you can also clearly see that any changes that were made based on deliberations which came from public submissions. So the public raised a concern, the committee looked at that concern, looked at what it had, and adjusted it slightly. The big changes that were made, so all the material changes, things that came up because of deliberations, maybe the conversation went a little bit this way, outside of what the public submission said, and the committee made a decision. The study tour was another factor. Those things were all published for comment. So I'm of the view that there is absolutely no need to republish the whole bill. It is accepted by our courts that there cannot be an obligation on Parliament or on a minister with regulations to keep on republishing simply because you've made changes based on the public's input. If that would have been a requirement, we would never stop publishing. We would never be able to pass legislation. So although it is always open to a committee to involve the public at any stage of its deliberations, and although it is open to this committee to re-advertise the full bill if the committee feels that it would like to do so, I do not think that it is necessary. We have fulfilled our obligation in terms of the Constitution to do public facilitation of public involvement. So I have done that exercise. It is definitely, I am satisfied that there is nothing that was material, nothing that was new, nothing that the public can say, but I didn't even know that I could comment on something like this. Those things, the levy, the consultation with the minister, the issue of the courts reducing the interest, those things were all consulted and advertised during the second portion. Thank you very much. That's my comments on the submission.
No, thank you very much, Advocate van der Merwe. What we are going to do, members, because I want us to have a solid engagement on this, and short of trying to run a gym here, I think the best next best choice is to break for tea. However, before you break for tea, I would like to ask the committee and certainly the indulgence of our guests here to just observe a minute of silence for the late Professor Bongani Moyisa's on his passing. He was awarded the Mapungubwe, Order of Mapungubwe, which really is only awarded, platinum, may I add, platinum, to somebody who has made an exceptional and unique contribution in whatever field. And we are aware, all of us in the country, I think this is above party politics, of the enormous contribution of this young man, relatively young man, who had so much more to offer. And it also highlights, and I think also calls on politicians, members of parliament, to take into account the huge impact that depression can have and anxiety on individuals who have the capacity and who are making a great contribution, not only, of course, in civil society, in the academic world, but even here in Parliament. And I would just ask you to observe one moment of silence before going out for tea. Thank you. He would like to pass our condolences on to his family and friends. I thank you.